So welcome everyone to the class for this week, and this week we're going to do a sutta which explores the mysterious way. We're not really going to do a sutta on this, I was just trying to segue kind of thing, but explores the mysterious ways in which, would you believe it, the right hand side of that photo is the monastery and the left hand side is not. That's in Perth, that happened yesterday. That's the fence of the monastery.
Which monastery?
Tibetan Buddhist Society in the hills. Can everyone see?
No.
Maybe do you want to maybe just close the curtains over there?
This one.
That's as big as the photo will go. On the right is a miracle, and on the left is not. So that's how I prefer to look at it. The same thing happened at Qigong Sanin's monastery a few years ago.
Is it real for
that? Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's just from the that's yesterday, that's what happened. People were inquiring about the monastery, and they just put the photos up to show people.
So the fire just stopped at the door?
Fire stopped at the other fence, yeah.
Which fire did you roll? Was that in Goldstone?
Not sure, 100% sure. They said Swan Valley, Fern Hill, ceramic.
Okay, that's the original fire.
Original fire, yeah. There's another photo. There's another photo that also shows the same thing.
It's not the yellow line yet. It's because the bush on the left, and it's just stupid. It's just a nice thing. It's the rain tree. It's actually a fire brick there, isn't it? That's why you didn't run all the way.
This is why you have protection mantras.
Oh, is it?
Well,
so mantra.
I think exactly. I think, pray to Allah and tie up your camel. Yeah, make the fire break and do the protection chants as well. That is quite amazing, though. Showing the efficacy of either protection chance or.
Well, the cost of bananas is going to go up.
Huh. I can see how that's affected by the bushfires. Okay, so this week's discourse is the Sunakata Sutta, the Sutta to Sunakata, and Sunakata means. Any Pali experts want to let us know what Sunakata means?
Isunakatia,
yes. That's a folk etymology. No. Nakata means a constellation. So su and su means good, whatever. So it translates as lucky star. Yeah, Sunakata means lucky star. except he doesn't have a very auspicious career in Buddhism. It's kind of ironic. Yeah, his whole name thing. He goes on a big argument with the Buddha later. This sutta we're going to read today is the first time we met the Buddha. In other suttas, he went on to have a big argument with the Buddha and then disrobed. So it's a kind of ironic thing.
He's a Lichavi.
He's a Lichavi, yeah. So this particular sutta doesn't have any corresponding suttas in Chinese. It does have a corresponding sutta in the Sanskrit, which is found in the Dirgha Agama of the Multisarvastivadins. So the Chinese Majjhima Agama, the parallel collection, is from Sarvastivadins, but they presumably had their version of the Sunakata Sutra in the Dirgha Agama, which is not exists extant in Chinese, explaining why that's not there. It's not possible to do a detailed comparative study of the Sunakata Sutta. But Venerable Analia has made a couple of notes based on the Sanskrit fragments, which do exist, which we'll glance at quickly later on, but there's nothing really too much of substance there. So the Sunakata's history, perhaps... briefly look at the Pali Dictionary of Proper Names for his history. Sunakatam. So to be Prince of Vesali, he was at one time a member of the Sangha and a personal attendant of the Buddha. So, interestingly enough, that detail that he was the personal attendant of the Buddha is one of the details that Analia says is actually found in the commentaries in the Pali tradition, but the Sutta in the Sanskrit tradition says the same thing. And that's actually a fairly common occurrence that we find that details found in the Pali commentaries are found in the other traditions in the actual text itself, whether it be the Sutta or the Vinaya. So to some extent it seems that the Sanskrit traditions were perhaps more open to including commentarial material in their suttas, whereas the Pali tradition tended to keep them more separate. He was later converted to the views of Kurakhatya, a naked ascetic in Uttaraka who bellowed like a dog, walked on all fours and licked up food with his mouth only. Sunakata, and I could see why you'd admire him. Yeah, but the Buddha prophesied that Kurakhatya would in 7 days die of epilepsy and be born among the Kala Kanjakas. And the prophecy proved true. Sunakata learned the truth from Kurakata's corpse. So there's a very kind of strange episode where Sunakata actually they actually kind of revive Kurakata's corpse and ask him where he's gone to. So Kala Kanjaka is a kind of asuras of fearsome shape, sort of a demon of some kind. Okay, so when he became converted to the views of Kurakhatya, he went around defaming the Buddha, saying he had nothing superhuman and was not distinguished from other men by preaching a saving faith, that the doctrine preached by him did not lead to the attraction of sorrow, etc. So he put on his arms round and basically heard all this and reported it to the Buddha, who thereupon preached the Mahasihanada Sutta. Okay, so this is the Mahasihanada Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha was at that time 80 years old, and the Lomahansa Jataka. The Sunakata Sutta was evidently preached to Sunakata before he joined the order. That's the sutta we're going to read today, while the Patika Sutta in the Digha Nikaya gives an account of his dissatisfaction and disrobal. His grievance was such that the Buddha showed no mystic superhuman wonders that he had not like this. See? The Buddha hadn't demonstrated anything like that for him.
This is how it would be at Santi, first of all. Just stop.
Uh-huh. Exactly, yeah, exactly. Because we break out some of the leaves under the trees and it would definitely stop there. No, I'm sure. So it had not shown him anything like that. Okay, so that's why he disrobed. So now I have shown you something like that. In fact, I've shown you not only something like that, I've shown you that itself. Therefore, you shouldn't disrobe. Okay, now work that out for yourself. His grievance was that the Buddha showed. Oh, we did that bit. The Buddha reminded him that he had not promised to do any of these things, and that at one time Sunakata had been loud in his praise of the Buddha the Dhamma. The Buddha warned him that people would say he had left the Sangha because its discipline had proved too hard for him. The Buddha told him that Kurakata would die and so on. And even so, Sunakata was not convinced. Later, he transferred his allegiance to Gandhara Masaka, who died as the Buddha prophesied, fallen from grace and fame. The next teacher to win the admiration of Sunakata was Patikaputta, and Sunakata wished the Buddha to pay honour to him. But the Buddha quoted to Sunakata the words of Ajita, the Lichavi general who had been born in Tava Tengsa, to the effect that Patikaputta was a liar and a cheat, and was later able to prove that these words were true. So he's this kind of sort of spiritual seeker. He's always kind of transferring his allegiance. Yeah, so he doesn't really have a proper grounded faith in the Dhamma. He's always going from one teacher to another and looking for something special, something a bit more spectacular, a bit more with a bit more zing in it. And a lot of people like that today, that go from one spiritual fad to the next. Something this year seems very trendy and exciting, and so they go along to that. Often these things turn out to not have a lot of substance. And so Sunakata did not return to the order. He'd probably remained in it for several years before leaving it. For we find in the Mahali Sutta the Lichavi Othadha, relating to the Buddha, how Sunakata had come to him 3 years after joining the Sangha, claiming that he could see divine forms but not hear divine heavenly sounds. Sunakata is identified with Kana Rita of the Bhuridatta Jataka. There seems to be, and this is perhaps a little bit beside the point, seems to be some ambiguity about Sunakata's dates, and I haven't investigated this in detail. As it says there in the Mahasayanada Sutta, it's Majjhima 12, and the Buddha is speaking in reference to Sunakata and says that he, the Buddha, is at that time 80 years old. So obviously that's right at the time of his death. On the other hand, Sunakata is supposed to have been a personal attendant of the Buddha, and so typically we understand that Ananda was the only personal attendant of the Buddha for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. So unless Sunakata ordained, in the early period, stayed for several decades in the Sangha, which is of course quite possible, then perhaps there's some chronological confusion, or perhaps perhaps the tradition that Ananda was the only personal attendant of the Buddha in the last period of his life was not correct. Not really sure about that, but it's just worth noting that in passing. Okay, so to come to the sutta itself, most of the sutta is available online in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Vaisali in the great hall in the wood with the peaked roof. Now on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus had declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One thus. So final knowledge is anya, and it means arahantship. We understand birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So, of course, this being one of the standard descriptions of arahantship, full enlightenment in Buddhism. Sunakata, the son of the Lichavis, heard a number of the bhikkhus have declared this, and then he went to the Buddha, paid respect, sat down to one side and said to him, I have heard, venerable sir, that a number of bhikkhus have declared arahantship in the presence of the Buddha. Did they do so rightly, or are there some bhikkhus here who declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves? So we can see from this question that Sunakata is showing his sort of great interest in the attainments of other people, right? He's not approaching to the Buddha to find out, well, how do I become an arahant, right? He approaches the Buddha because he wants to know who else is an arahant. And of course this shows that tendency which you see again and again in Sunakata's life. He wants to find somebody external, somebody out there who can be enlightened for him, in a sense, So he's got this character that always wants to project these notions of enlightenment on others rather than being interested in his own state of mind too much. And again, this is something which is very common. Yeah, people want to go around and find out who's enlightened and who's got the special stuff. Seem to think that the spiritual search is based on finding out who's the most enlightened and the most special and so on. Of course, the reality is that all of those ones who really are most enlightened and most special didn't spend their life wandering around trying to find somebody who was the most enlightened and most special, but they spent their life actually doing the practice themselves. So the Buddha's response: when those bhikkhus, Sunakata, declared final knowledge in my presence, there were some bhikkhus who declared final knowledge rightly, and there were some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves. Okay, so the Buddha giving a typically reasonable and balanced response. He's not trying to assert that everybody in my religion or everyone who says it is enlightened, but nor is he trying to show that, you know, he doesn't want to destroy someone's faith and say that nobody has it. He's not taking a cynical point of view. So it's this kind of answer. This is the kind of vibhajyavada point of view, analytical point of view. It's not giving a one-sided answer to the question. Therein, when bhikkhus declare final knowledge rightly, their declaration is true. But when bhikkhus declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, the Tathagata thinks, that's of course the Buddha, thinks, I should teach them the Dhamma. Thus it is the case, Sunakata, the Tathagata thinks I should teach them the Dhamma, but some misguided men here formulate a question, come to the Tathagata and ask it. In that case, Sunakata, though the Tathagata has thought I shall teach them the Dhamma, he changes his mind. Okay? So the last part of the passage is not 100% clear, but the basic idea here, the most important point, is that when people are overestimating themselves, the Buddha's thought is that he should teach them the Dhamma. So it's not that he's trying to disprove them. He doesn't sort of criticize them and say that, you know, you're a fool because you've overestimated yourself or something like that. And he's not making a personal statement or personal attack, but he wants to teach them the Dhamma that can show them the way to investigate and reflect in themselves where they are at and how they can progress in their practice. And what that points to is the fact that actually overestimation is very, very normal. In fact, it's probably universal. It's probably everybody who's ever got some kind of spiritual attainment at some point along the way has suffered from overestimation of one form or another. It might be just very mild, yeah. It might be nothing huge, or people can get stuck for years thinking that they're in some kind of stage and then afterwards they realise that they weren't. So these things, this kind of thing is very, very common. And it certainly is the case for many, if not most, of the forest Ajahns in the Thai forest tradition. And I've heard people talk about this several times. And so this is something to bear in mind, because you will hear this fairly frequently in Buddhism. People will say, I've got this or I've got that, I've got this jhana or I've got that attainment or whatever. And sometimes we can be very sceptical, yeah? But remember that the Buddha's approach here is not to criticize somebody or whatever. It's actually very normal. The thing is to teach the Dhamma so that people can continue to practice and can continue to progress. And if one problem is, of course, if you criticize them too much, then they can actually lose all their self-confidence and actually end up stop practicing altogether. I mentioned briefly this kind of famous story in the Ajahn Mahabua's biography of Ajahn Mun, where he went to was reading the mind of another monk, and he knew that he was, you know, having unwholesome thoughts and was, you know, going to disrobe and so on. So he went down and criticized him and, you know, said, you know, you've got to watch your mind, you've got to... And the guy was so terrified that he just picked up his things and ran off, and he never heard from him again, yeah? So if you're too strong, then also that can have can have the wrong effect. Okay, so sometimes he changes his mind, okay? So this is the Buddha, you know, always, you know, can't make a decision, you know. But of course, he changes his mind when the situation warrants it. So in this case, you know, it looks like somebody's going to be sincere, but then when he realizes that they're questioning and they're coming in from the wrong place, then he will change his mind and decide not to teach them. So when he says this, then Sunakata says, This is the time, Blessed One, this is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to teach the Dhamma. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then listen to Nakata and attend closely to what I shall say. Remembering at this time, Sunakata himself wasn't ordained yet. So the Blessed One said this: there are Sunakata, these five kinds of sensual pleasures. What are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five chords or five kinds of sensual pleasure. Okay, it is possible, Sunakata, that some person here may be intent on worldly material things. In other words, things which are connected with these five kinds of sensual pleasure. When a person is intent on worldly material things, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that type of person and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about the imperturbable is going on, he will not listen to it or give it ear or exert his mind to understand it. He does not associate with that kind of person and he does not find satisfaction in that. So in this paragraph, the word imperturbable, as is made clear later on in the sutta, is a reference to certain very refined states of meditation. And in this case, usually the imperturbable refers to the fourth jhana. In this case, to the fourth jhana, and the first two of the formless attainments are meant here. Now, so the idea here is this is kind of a basic principle of Buddhist psychology, is that our mind, our inclinations, our thinking, our behavior, and our emotional connection it follows along with those things that we're interested in. Yeah. And so it goes to that. And we're always thinking, if we really like motorbikes, then we think about motorbikes all the time, yeah? Which is better? Is a Ducati better or a Harley better? And we're thinking about this model or that model and so on and so forth. And so somebody, their mind's always going around that, yeah? And somebody else has got no interest in motorbikes whatsoever. And you say, what's a Ducati and what's a Harley? And they wouldn't even know what they are, yeah? So this is people's inclination of people's minds. It follows what you're interested. So that the more that you're intent on worldly material things, and the more that your mind will incline with that, and of course the more that your mind inclines in that way, the easier it becomes. Your mind tends to go down those same pathways again and again and again. Yeah, and so the more you follow those pathways, the stronger they become in the mind. But when talk about the imperturbable is going on, he will not listen to it. So when talk about those refined spiritual things that happen, then you won't be interested. And of course we know that that's very much the case, and it's one of the bases of Buddhist teaching and so on, is that there's no real point in trying to teach Dhamma to somebody who's not interested in it. Yeah, it's just a waste of time. Yeah, for some reason, there has to be something inside a person which responds in some way to the Dhamma and which wants to take an interest in those teachings, which wants to do the meditation. Somebody who has to have that inner inspiration. Otherwise, we can really waste a lot of time trying to push our teaching on others. So the Buddha then goes on to give a simile. Suppose Sunakata, a man had left his own village or town a long time ago, and he were to see another man who had only recently left that same village or town. He would ask that man whether the people of that village or town were safe, prosperous and healthy. And that man would tell him whether the people were safe, prosperous and healthy. What do you think, Sunakata? Would that first man listen to him, give him ear and exert his mind to understand? Yes, Venerable Sir. So too, Sunakata, it's possible that some person here may be intent on worldly material things. When a person is intent on worldly material things, then his thinking and pondering is in line with that, and he doesn't find satisfaction in the imperturbable. So then it goes on to the second case. It's possible, Sunakata, that some person here may be intent on the imperturbable. So intent on these very high states, very refined states of meditation. When a person is intent on the imperturbable, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about worldly material things is going on, he will not listen to it, or give it ear, or exert his mind to understanding it. He does not associate with that kind of person, and he does not find satisfaction in that. Just as a yellow leaf that has fallen from its stalk is incapable of becoming green again, so too Sunakata, when a person is intent on the imperturbable, he has shed the fetter of worldly material things. He should be understood as a person detached from the fetter of worldly material things who is intent on the imperturbable. So, I think one thing that strikes me as a little bit curious about this sutta is that it makes a big jump from, you know, being concerned about worldly material things to then being concerned with the imperturbable, you know, these very, very refined meditation state. Not even the ordinary four jhanas or anything like that. Not only is that a big gap there, a big jump in the normal course of teaching, it's also a bit strange in the context of Sunakata, who it seems is possibly his first encounter with the Buddha. One might have thought that he would have taken a more gradual approach, as the Buddha did in so many other cases. And if you compare this approach to, say, the Samanyapala Sutta we studied last year, where the Buddha's response to King Ajatasattu was very much to engage him at his own level, and then very, very gradually to bring him to the more high spiritual teachings. So I'm not quite sure why this leap is found in this sutta. So just as a yellow leaf that's fallen from its stalk is incapable of becoming green again, when a person's intent on the imperturbable, he's shed the fetter of worldly material things.
Okay, last one. It seems pretty unlikely to be Christ's first attempt to Buddha. I mean, if you are, but monks are
important
there.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so maybe he'd been associating with the community for some time already, yeah? Could well be. It could. I mean, it's every likelihood that he would have been, you know, listening to talks and things. Maybe this is the first time he had an interview with the Buddha, but he may well have been with the community for some time. Quite possible.
When he's referred to the intent on the imperturbable, I'd like to think I was intent on the imperturbable, but whether it's, you know, what does it actually mean, intent on the imperturbable? Is it somebody who's actually practicing or
entertaining fourth jhana? Yeah, I think it means. I think it probably means either somebody who is ripe for it. Yeah. So maybe somebody who has already the meditative foundation and has a feeling that they're ready for that next step, or perhaps also somebody who has already attained it and perhaps is consolidating that attainment. Yeah.
It also seems to be saying this person who's at this very refined level isn't interested in anything else, just that's all he wants to talk about.
Well, it's not saying they can't talk about other things, just saying it doesn't turn them on. Yeah, it's going to be a bit, So, and then it goes through the different, the next highest meditation stages. It's possible that someone's interested in the base of nothingness, the sphere of nothingness, an even more refined state of meditation. And someone's intent on that is he's not interested in the imperturbable, doesn't listen to it or give it ear or exert his mind to understand it. Just as a thick stone that has split in two cannot be joined together again, so too, Sunakata, when a person is intent on the basis of nothingness, his fetter of the imperturbable has been split. He's detached from the fetter of the imperturbable, who is intent on the basis of nothingness. Another thing which strikes me as a little bit curious about this sutta is that these similes, you know, seem to be, you know, well, they're clearly suggesting that someone at this stage then can't be fall back to an interest in lower things once they've reached the higher things, whereas normally we understand that maybe they're not interested in them at that time, but it's entirely possible that that they should fall back and become interested in it later on. So I'm not quite sure what the talked about later in the suttas, in fact. So I'm not quite sure about that. Why these similes are structured in this way?
How does the
what? Sorry. How is it? Why isn't it? In terms of meaning, then yeah, you could say that Nibbana also is imperturbable, but it's just a technical term that's usually used for the fourth jhana.
But in here, now that the Buddha was talking about the place and offering as being less than intentional
meaning. No, it's more than.
No, it's less than. Because the Buddha is saying that because it's less than intentional and place and offering, it's being,
and he's not intent on the imperturbable. Yeah, it's working its way up to Nibbana. Yeah, we're working our way up. Yeah.
Maybe it's just that, once you think this is the biggest mountain, and then you find a bigger one, and
say,
no, this is the biggest mountain.
That mountain is rubbish, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Could it also mean that when he has already reached that state,
yeah,
he's not necessarily going to go back to the lower?
Sure.
He doesn't have to go back to the north. I mean, he's already reached the highest.
Yeah, that's true, and that's not a problem. The problem for me, just a point of curiosity, is why you can't go back. Yeah, that seems.
It's the way it's being worded.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
Maybe you can check with your party. Why are you not checking with your party today?
because nothing strikes me as being necessary to check it seems clear enough.
But if you lay your brain and the higher stakes and more kinism, so why do you want some less kinism?
Again, not a problem to say that somebody wouldn't want to go back, but it's whether it's. Yeah.
But you still wouldn't really want to start from most of you.
I would imagine that somebody intends on the basis of all of these things. You just
want to
be chatting
about it. You just go. The fetter of the imperturbable is broken. It's not to be rejoined again. Right, so then it's possible, panam kopanetam, that somebody, person here, may be intent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and only talk in that interests him and so on, and that he thinks the base of nothingness is rubbish. That's not a literal translation there, I'm just paraphrasing. Okay, suppose a person has eaten some delicious food and then thrown it up again. What do you think, Sunakata? Could that man have any desire to eat that food again?
Well, he's very hungry. He's eating from it.
Yeah, well, that's one for the Dhamma experts, yeah. Could that person... No, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because the food's considered repulsive. So too, Sunakata, when a person's intent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception, his fetter at the base of nothingness has been rejected. It's been vomited. Okay, it's possible, Sunakata, that some person here may be completely intent on Nibbana. When a person is completely intent on Nibbana, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that. He associates with that kind of person, he finds satisfaction in that, but when talk about the base of neither perception nor non-perception is going on, he will not listen to it, or give it ear, or exert his mind to understand it. He does not associate with that kind of person, and he does not find satisfaction in that. Just as a palm tree with its top cut off is incapable of growing again, so too, Sunakata, when a person is completely intent on Nibbana, his fetter of the base of neither perception nor non-perception has been cut off. And so, of course, this itself being a very common simile for arahantship, And in this context, the finality of it is very, very appropriate. So it's possible, Sunakata, that some bhikkhu here might think thus: craving has been called an arrow by the recluse. The recluse, of course, being an epithet of the Buddha. The poisonous humour of ignorance. Humour here doesn't mean ha 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 humour. Humour means it's an old-fashioned word for what would you call them? The humours, the like a kind of liquid, different liquids in the body. You have like bile, phlegm, pus, and so on. Toxin, exactly. Yeah, a few poisonous toxin of ignorance is spread about by desire, lust, and ill will. That craving, this arrow of craving, has been removed from me. The poisonous toxin of ignorance has been expelled. I am one who is completely intent on Nibbana. Since he conceives himself thus, though it is contrary to fact, he might pursue those things that are unsuitable for one completely intent on Nibbana. He might pursue the sight of unsuitable forms with the eye, or unsuitable sounds with the ear, unsuitable odours with the nose, unsuitable flavours with the tongue, unsuitable tangibles with the body, or unsuitable mind objects with the mind. By unsuitable, it just means those things that tend to stimulate various attachments and unwholesome desires or whatever. When he pursues the sight of these things, lust invades his mind. When his mind invaded by lust, he would incur death or deadly suffering. Suppose, Sunakata, a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon. The surgeon would cut around the opening of the wound with a knife, then he would probe for the arrow with a probe, and he would pull out the arrow and would expel the poisonous toxin, leaving a trace of it behind. Thinking that no trace was left behind, and there's a slight variance in the readings here, Bhikkhu Bodhi has a footnote on that, he would say, good man, the arrow has been pulled out from you, the poisonous toxin has been expelled with no trace left behind, and it is incapable of harming you. Eat only suitable food, do not eat unsuitable food, or else the wound may suppurate. From time to time wash the wound, and from time to time anoint its opening so that pus and blood do not cover the opening of the wound. Do not walk around in the wind and sun, or else dust and dirt may infect the opening of the wound. Take care of your wound, good man, and see to it that the wound heals. So in this case, the surgeon's done their job, but there's just a little bit of poison left in there, but he thinks that there is really none. So the man thinks the arrow has been pulled out, the toxin's been expelled, and there's no trace left behind. It's incapable of harming me. He eats unsuitable food, and the wound suppurates. He doesn't wash it, nor does he anoint the opening, and pus and blood covers the opening of the wound. He'd walk around in the wind and the sun, and dust and dirt would infect the opening of the wound. He would not take care of it, nor see to it that it heals. Then, both because he does what is unsuitable, and because a trace was left behind, the wound would swell, and with its swelling he would incur death or deadly suffering. And so too, and Bhikkhu might reflect in that same way. And the Buddha then says, for it is death in the discipline of the noble one, is the Arya Vinaya, is the phrase here, and obviously just means in Buddhism, when one abandons the training and reverts to the low life, and it is deadly suffering when one commits some defiled offence. So, of course, this is kind of an ironic phrase here to Sunakata, who would himself, of course, end up disrobing. And the defiled offence here is a reference to various kind of serious offences, especially Sangha Disesa offences. It's possible, Sunakata, that some bhikkhu here might think thus: craving's been called an arrow, and the arrow's been removed by me. He would not pursue the sight of unsuitable sight, sound, smell, taste, and touches, and because his mind is not infected by lust, he would not incur death or deadly suffering. Suppose, Sunakata, a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon. The surgeon cleaned it and expelled the toxin without leaving a trace behind. Knowing that no trace was left behind, he would tell the man, give the man the advice same advice to look after the wound. The man would, in fact, look after the wound in the proper way. Then, because he does what is suitable and because no trace was left behind when the toxin was expelled, the wound would heal. And because it had healed and was covered with skin, he would not incur death or deadly suffering. And so this is the case for the bhikkhu who is genuinely intent on nibbana and who practices with the restraint that doesn't allow his mind to be invaded with suffering. So Nakata, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning here. Wound is a term for the six internal senses. It's a basis, but the six internal senses. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Nose, tongue, body, and mind. So that's a fairly harsh description, and it's actually again, there's another slightly unusual feature of the sutra as a whole, is that it's a fairly strongly worded and quite powerful sutta, which, you know, as we know from reading the Majjhima Nikaya, it's relatively unusual for the Buddha to use this kind of language. He does from time to time, but again, I find it a little bit unusual that he would use it for with a layman who apparently is quite fresh in the Dhamma. In the Sanskrit, instead of the wound being the six internal senses, the wound is the body, which relates to the simile which Sariputta gives for Sariputta's was the workman waiting for the wages. Somebody was said the simile for the body is like it's not something which you look after because you're attached to it or because you are trying to find delight through your body, but because you're looking after it just the way you look after a wound. You don't look after a wound because you're attached to it and you like it. You're looking after a wound just because it's the right thing to do. So the wound is a term for the six internal senses. Poisonous toxin is a term for ignorance. Arrow is a term for craving. Probe, and he's getting the arrow out, is a term for mindfulness. Knife is a term for noble wisdom. Surgeon is a term for the Tathagata, the accomplished one, the fully enlightened one. That bhikkhu Sunakata is one who practices restraint in the six internal senses, having understood that acquisition, this is upadhi, meaning attachment basically, is the root of suffering, being acquisitionless, liberated in the destruction of the acquisitions. It is not possible that he would direct his body or arouse his mind towards any acquisition. Use of the word acquisitions is a little bit kind of liberated in the destruction of the acquisitions.
That's the one that's used in the dependent origination when it goes into
That's actually a different word, yeah. That's right, yeah. That's a different word. I can't remember what the word is itself, but it's a different word. A different Pali word, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. This one is upadhi, pretty sure. And that one, I can't remember what that one is, but it's not upadhi. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's parigaha. Upadhi sankhaye vimutto. Yeah, so it's upadhi. Mahani Dana Sutta, that one, that would be, I think that would be. Vedana, so it goes feeling, and then from feeling it goes pariyesana. So from feeling it goes to craving. Tanha is craving. From craving goes to pariyesana, is seeking, questing. From pariyesana it goes to labha. Labha is probably what's translated as acquisition there. Gains or getting something. Yeah. Labha conditions vinichaya is decision. Yeah, so it's probably lava. That's more in a physical sense, material sense, yeah, of gains.
So do you think this other word is
upadhi? Upadhi is one of these words in Pali, a bit like karma, which has both a subjective and an objective sense. So upadhis can mean refer to the material stuff that you own. So there's a classic sutta in the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha is having a dialogue with a farmer, and the farmer says, "Here I am secure because I have all my upadhis. I have my cows, I have my fields, I have my home, I have my wife, I have my sons, assets." Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the Buddha says, "Well, I'm secure because I don't have any upadhis. I don't have any assets." Assets probably a good rendering rather than acquisitions. Yeah, I don't really like acquisitions. So liberated in the destruction of acquisitions. Free from the ending of attachments. That's a better, more idiomatic translation. Okay. So, suppose Sunakata, they were a bronze cup of beverage possessing a good colour, smell and taste, but it was mixed with poison, and a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. What do you think, Sunakata? Would that man drink that beverage, knowing if I drink this I will incur death or deadly suffering? No, Venerable, so we run out of the sutta here. Don't have the last page. No, Bhante, so too, that bhikkhu is one who practices restraint in the six bases in the six sense bases, having understood that assets are the root of suffering, being assetless, freed from the ending of assets. Perhaps. It's all stuff. I like stuff. Freed because he doesn't have any stuff anymore. It's not possible that he would direct his body or arouse his mind towards any acquisitions. So, of course, this comes back to that overall theme of the whole thing is that your mind follows the, and your behaviour follows the direction of your desire, what you're interested in. Suppose in Nakata there were a deadly poisonous snake and a man came who wanted to live, not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. What do you think, Sunakata? Would that man give that deadly poisonous snake his hand or his thumb, thinking, if I'm bitten by him, I'll incur death or deadly suffering? Here, snakey wakey. No, Venerable Sir. So too, when a bhikkhu practices restraint, it's not possible that he would direct his body or mind towards any object of attachment. Oh, interesting. In the last word, bhikkhu bodhi has attachment here instead of acquisition. I wonder if that's a mistake. Yeah, so it's the same Pali word, is upadhi. Yeah. So look, I'm not sure, is this the latest one? There were a couple of very minor mistakes in the first edition of the Majjhima, but Bhikkhu Bodhi's kind of corrected them as they've gone. This one is the 2005 edition, it still has that. Oh dear, I'll pop him off an email. Look, it's very easy to overlook these things. Alright. So this is we were just going to have a brief look at the the parallels in the Sanskrit. As I mentioned before, it was found in the Sarvasivada or Mula Sarvasivada Dirgha Agama collection. When we sometimes write the Mula Sarvasivada like this is because there's a great deal of ambiguity around these schools in the histories. We're not quite sure to what extent that these really were separate schools, and it's quite likely there may have been several different collections in different parts of India that were slightly different, and it's also not clear if they were separate schools, whether they had any different doctrines. Usually the identifications of the collections are made on the basis of doctrine. So you find certain indications that will differentiate one school from another. But since it's not clear whether there was any doctrinal difference between the two, it's not even 100% clear if it was really two different schools, then it's often very hard to find meaningful differences that will allow us to sort of decide whether it's really Sarvasivada or Mula Sarvasivada. Okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning, the Sanskrit text says that Sunakata had been the attendant of the Buddha, which is mentioned in the Pali commentary. And it's a little bit curious because he's not even a monk at this stage. Yeah, I just thought I was just checking because it always refers to monks as ayasma, and it just says that he's a Lichaviputta, so it seems pretty certain that he's not actually a bhikkhu. But again, I mean, that itself could be another textual mistake, I'm not sure. Interestingly enough, according to the Pali commentaries on the Sanyutta Nikaya, the role of Sunakata as one of the Buddha's attendants had been handed down in the canonical texts. Huh? So that's interesting. And so the actual quote here, and so this is interesting just to look at this idiom for those, well, it's interesting for Pali geeks. Sunakato, so this is from the commentary, ime pana, that just means, and so, Paliyam, in the Pali, yeah? So when the commentaries use the word Pali, they don't mean Pali language, they mean the sutta. Okay, so the word Pali, when it's used in the commentaries, refers to the root text, the text on which the commentaries are commenting. Okay, so in the Pali, agatu uppataka. Okay, so the uppataka is the attendant. Okay, and this word here, agata, means come. It has come down. So it has come down in the text that he was the uppataka. And so this agata is also the same word as we use for the word agama, meaning the collection of the canon. So it's interesting to notice that the commentary usage, the word agata and agama, is still very current to describe the what we call the four nikayas. Sorry? Right. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so that's really the earlier meaning of it. The actual usage of it to describe a language seems to be quite late. Yeah.
So is agata canon or handed down?
Yeah, it means it has come down in the text.
Is it the same word as in like perigata or?
No, it's a different word. No, gata is a different word. Yeah. Yeah, that means verse. Yeah, this is from the root gum to go, and so this is a past participle. The prefix ar signifies to come rather than going. So agata means come down. From the same root as tathagata, yeah. Yep. So this is come down in the text. So the literal meaning is what has come down, but it comes to be used idiomatically to mean the text itself. So you could say it has come down. You could have said in the agama it has come down. So you could say it has come down in what has come down, but that's not what's said here. But the interesting point is that the commentaries are saying that this is in the canon, but it's not actually in the canon as it stands today, in the Pali canon, right? And so you do find these things occasionally in the commentaries. Very, very rarely they'll refer to something in the canon which doesn't quite match up with what we have today in the Pali text. So it's not entirely, I'm not aware of any detailed study of that. It could be that the canon has changed somewhat since that day. I mean, it might have only been a word or two has changed since that time. Although, you know, to put it in perspective, I mean, the commentaries are commenting on thousands and thousands of suttas, yeah, so it's hardly surprising that they should get one or two things wrong. It's also possible that remembering that the commentaries themselves are compilations based on earlier commentaries. So it's possible that the earlier commentaries might have been using a slightly different version of the canon, and that because of an editing slip-up, as we saw even in such a well-edited text as Bhikkhu Bodhi's Majjhima Nikaya, it's possible for even the most careful and thorough editors to make occasional mistakes. So the Sinakata Sutta, a discourse in the Digha Nikaya depicts Sunakata following the Buddha on alms round, although that doesn't really mean he was his attendant. His personal relationship with the Buddha by serving as the Buddha's attendant stands in contrast to his later behaviour, since Sunakata not only left the order but even went so far as to publicly proclaim that the Buddha had not reached any higher realisation. If Sunakata was Buddha's attendant, that would certainly agree with his character, in that he's always after this kind of personal connection with the great spiritual leader. Yeah? So you can imagine that he would have been really ambitious to sort of get in that role of being the attendant, so he could hang around with the Buddha a lot and get to see some cool psychic powers or something. Meghya, that's right, Meghya Sutta, This contrast between his earlier close association with the Buddha and his later behaviour may explain why the Pali discourses Sunakata is not explicitly qualified as the Buddha's attendant. Perhaps, judging from the Sanskrit fragments of Sunakata Sutta, may be the canonical text referred to in the commentary. Although this explicit identification of his role is not found in the present Pali version. A relatively minor difference, as I mentioned before, that's just saying that the body, what's the six internal sense bases in the Pali, is called the body in the Sanskrit. Of course, it being, from the Buddhist point of view, effectively the same thing, because your six internal senses, from a subjective point of view, is exactly the same as the body. Yeah? That's how you experience the body. Objectively, they're different things. Yeah, from somebody who stands outside, would say that the six senses are only part of your body. Like your toenail, for example, is not part of the six senses. Whereas from the internal perception, everything is part. Okay, the Sanskrit title was possibly the Shalya Sutra, the discourse on the arrow. And the Sanskrit version might have had a different conclusion than the Pali, but the text is too fragmentary at the moment. There's only a few words there, but Analia suggests that perhaps the Sanskrit text ended up with an exhortation for the monks to meditate. And it has, you see some of the words here mentioned in the Sanskrit text. So you can see what the scholars are working with. You have the mulam, meaning root, so probably a root of a tree, but it's actually only L-A-M, which is in the text, right? So the mu bit has been reconstructed. So you've just got lung, and then you have giri guha palala punja, the mountain cave and the heap of straw, but again mostly just reconstructed. So these, when we say that these things are fragmentary, they really are fragmentary. So this is the Sunakata Sutta. So does anyone have any more questions? We have several copies of the Majjhima Nikaya downstairs. Yeah, so you can borrow, take a copy to read in Kuti or whatever. Yeah.
Have any theories about why it might jump straight from material things into?
No, I mean it's purely speculative, but the only thing perhaps that was something that Sunakata himself was interested in. If the Buddha knew that Sunakata maybe had been going around asking the monks, oh, have you got this formless attainment, or have you got this imperturbable thing or something, then perhaps he could have been using it in that way. But
it's just, yeah, I mean, the guy does come out to the
Bit of a mystery. I think when you think the overall tenor of the sutra is very straightforward, but there are a couple of things that are slightly curious about it. You mean at the same time?
No, I mean to generally this Amandai
being
supposed to not,
did he have any other ones? Yeah, as Blake mentioned earlier, Meghia was the attendant at one point, and there was another one, I think Naga. Yeah, I think four or five that recorded, but it's probably not the only ones. I mean, there's just occasional suttas where it mentions it, so I presume that for the first period of his life he had various attendants, and later on Ananda was the sole attendant.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sometimes he just walked off into the bush, didn't he? Yeah. But that was part of Ananda's job, is to know, oh, the Buddha wants to be left alone. Yeah, so that was his sensitivity. Yeah.
Perhaps if he was so interested in all these interesting states of mind, mm-hmm. he was going around asking about them, the Buddha was trying to impress upon him that, well, you can't just, once you've got that, you can't just rest there.
Right.
There's still lots of work to do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, if it was the case that Sunakta had been, you know, really fascinated by these meditation states.
Because
yeah.
I think it's quite interesting the way that the first simile, that, you know, the poison, like if you, it seems to be saying that it's easy to slip back if you haven't absolutely totally eradicated
defilements, right. And
craving, then and you think you have,
yeah. Yeah.
And then you go back to your worldly material pursuits and talking about that stuff, and you lost it.
That's right.
Is that that one? I'm assuming that's what the simile is trying to say.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if there's no more questions, let's finish by paying respects.
Swakato.